Money and markets. Cui bono Ferguson is where we begin. I got a lot of questions this week on what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. The definitive comment when the governor called in the Missouri National Guard was a statement he gave. I posted it on the blog in a commentary called Cui bono Ferguson. Tonight, a day of hope, prayers, and peaceful protests were marred by, quote, and this is the governor speaking, violent criminal acts of an organized and growing number of individuals, many from outside the community and state. So what you were watching was clearly a very engineered kind of situation. And I mentioned in the blog post that I was reminded of the time when I had a former intelligence operations person educate me as to how they triggered and sort of engineered the 1968 race riots in the United States. And it was a very educational experience. And I've never viewed riots the same way since then. If you look at what's going on in this country, crime has been dropping steadily. And so when you see riots of these kind, of course, my immediate thought is whose payroll is financing the individuals involved? And I think that's a very important question because clearly a lot of the violence was coming from outside influences. There is a long history of minority neighborhoods being used for covert operations from narcotics trafficking, gun running, slave trafficking. I grew up in a minority neighborhood, and I watched a lot of it, certainly, and it's part of what got me interested in what and sort of studying some of the things I've studied and I talk about and write about, including narcotics trafficking. There's also been an effort since the 90s, and it's something I alluded to in my story, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, of the feds to try and control local police with grant programs, with asset seizures where they can make money, adopting the seizures through the federal program, lots of training, and now provision of equipment. We see all sorts of stories about provision of equipment. And so there's a real issue of the feds trying to control the local police, or we see in the coverage of situations like Ferguson, Missouri, trying to persuade us that we can't trust the local police. Instead, we need to turn to the feds, which is hooey. Because if you look at traditionally who's brought in and protected the narcotics trafficking, the gun running, everything, it's been the feds. Not to say that they didn't partner with local police or the state troopers and state police. It depends on the particular place and situation. One of my big questions is how did Michael Brown, the teenager who was shot, how did he manage to get six bullets from a policeman? What caused it? What really happened? Was it incompetence? Was it a sniper? Was it mind control? Was it that the policeman really felt he was threatened? I don't think we know the facts, and it's going to take a serious investigation to get the facts. I put up Alec Jones's interview with Fritz Springmeier because I think mind control with six bullets, if the policeman did shoot, mind control is a very serious possibility. And to understand situations like this, you really do need to understand mind control. Again, things are not as they seem. We have a Solari report that I did, sort of an introduction and overview on mind control, and it gives you some of the best movies and books. One book, if you're interested, is Secret Don't Tell by Carla Emery. Very good book. But when you have mind control and you have professional forces trying to engineer a riot from outside, you've got a real problem. If you look at the governor and also the Missouri State Trooper he had put in charge, very competent guy who is from the community, has good relations with the community and churches, it's hard to believe that someone like that couldn't manage the situation unless you had professionals from outside working it. The idea that Eric Holder showing up as a savior is the hypocrisy of it is so mind-numbing you don't even know what to say. I know I keep beating this drum, but Holder was instrumental in dropping teams of SWAT teams basically in poor neighborhoods in Washington when he was D.C. attorney, and sort of rounding up any innocent kids, throwing them in prison at the same time that the public defender's offices were having their appropriations and grants slashed so that it was easy to process them in to essentially prisons where the Department of Justice could make a profit marketing that labor to the Department of Defense and other government agencies. So if you look at the Nazi model of slave labor, it was essentially no different, particularly if you look at who's engineering the drugs into that community. So for Eric Holder to show up and act like he's the savior is absolutely absurd. In terms of mind-numbing hypocrisy, we see Cuomo again, as I said last week, buying with settlements paid by the big banks he partnered with to create the housing bubble. And so between Cuomo this week and Holder handing out the goodies to the communities that they were instrumental in sort of raping on the theory that they're there to protect you from the local guys you can't trust, it's really, again, the hypocrisy is mind-numbing. At the same time, for people like Cuomo and Holder and the folks who support them, the polls seem to reaffirm that they can get away with it. And as one former CIA agent said to me, you know what your problem is, lady? You don't understand that the average IQ is 103. So they seem to think people are never going to figure out as long as the corporate media and entrainment supports it. And so the question that we all wait to see is will they? Now, if you go back and read one of the most popular blog posts we've ever had on the Saleri Report blog, it's one called Financial Coup d'Etat, where I talk about the networks that engineered the rape of Russia, and includes a description of presentations I saw at a London investment conference from Ann Williamson and John Laughlin about the rape of Russia and the sort of rape of Eastern Europe. And one of the reasons that I became so keenly interested in revisiting those networks and how they relate to what is going on in the Ukraine was when I first saw the presentation by Zach Taylor, the video that I posted about 2 or 3 weeks on the blog. It mentioned in passing that the leading force in Mexico City in the Mexican drug cartels is the Russian mafia. And that really triggered a process for me. It was one of the reasons I wanted to get Zach to come onto the Saleri Report. If you study the rape of Russia, it was a combination of the U.S. intelligence agencies, what I would describe as the breakaway civilization investment networks, and the Russian mafia teamed up to kind of rape the place. Robert Friedman, who I described last week, wrote a great book called Red Mafia about the Russian mafia. And one of the things he pointed out was they're 99% Jewish, which meant many of them had had eligibility to get Israeli passports, which enabled them not only to get Israeli passports, but then to launder just enormous amounts of money out through Israel. They also, I believe, laundered significant money through New York. And in that process, built out deep networks into Israel and New York. They were probably deep before, but much deeper, because that was a huge flow of money. But it was interesting to see sort of the breakaway networks and the Jewish networks, who oftentimes you would think would seem at odds, but they seem to certainly in that situation, collaborated, and we'll see. We'll talk to Anne a lot more about it. I bring up that again because I wrote a review last week, or I mentioned Against Our Better Judgment by Alison Weir, which is a story of the creation of the State of Israel. And one of the things she describes is the extent to which the Zionists cooperated with the Nazis. The Zionists wanted to persuade Jews to immigrate to Palestine, and of course the Nazis wanted them to leave. And it talks sort of about the deep collaboration, and it's a interesting historical background for some of the kind of collaboration we may be looking at. The question I have is what are the ties between the networks in Gaza, operating in Gaza and the Ukraine and on the border? Because if you look at the flows of money, certainly the Russian mafia networked deeply into all three places. And I mentioned there's a link in the Cui Bono Ferguson commentary about the Mexican drug cartels teaching children to work as assassins. Now, I don't think the kids coming across the border necessarily trained and in deep yet enough to be in a place like Ferguson, so I'm not trying to imply that, but one of the things Zach and I talk about is the extent to which children make very successful assassins, and that's a very old practice, including by the groups like the drug cartels and certainly by the U.S. intelligence agencies. I asked a person this week as I was looking into it why I've always associated the breakaway networks much more with old WASP and Nazi kind of background, but very WASPy. And I said, why is there this long history of the breakaway networks and the Nazis working with the Zionist networks? What's that about? And they said, well, you know, they both see themselves as very superior. And they hold that in common. And so in that sense, they have the basis of collaboration. One thing I will say is, in my experience, that both the breakaways and the U.S. intelligence agencies have used the Mossad to do dangerous or dirty work for them. And so I think that may, in fact, be part of the collaboration. But I'm very curious to see who ultimately it looks like is behind some of the Ferguson. But if I had to guess, it would be a joint venture of those networks again. I also wanted to mention, I was looking into some of the funding in the Mississippi runoff campaigns. You have longtime Senator Thad Cochran, who was behind in the polls in the Republican primary in Mississippi, which is right to the south of me here in Hickory Valley, Tennessee. He was behind in the polls up against Chris McDaniel, who was a state senator or a state legislator who was associated with being a Tea Party candidate. Funding poured into Mississippi, into third-party groups that basically spent most of their money running hits on McDaniels, and some of the money came from Karl Rove's PAC. But it also, again, a series of private investors from outside of Mississippi. There were certainly Mississippi folks, but it looked to me like a surprising number of folks from outside, including, again, people I would associate with sort of the breakaway-related investment networks, and then very wealthy Jewish folks. It's the same theme of this breakaway plus Zionist, and included $250,000 to Michael Bloomberg. So you look at the two groups and you kind of think, huh. And it reminds me again how Bloomberg preaching against guns to me is pretty frightening. And you kind of wonder what this money is doing coming into Mississippi, except you need to remember Mississippi is critical to the post-Katrina New Orleans Mississippi Delta. You know, I've said for a long time that I think the reason the gentrification has preceded New Orleans is that whole area is critical if you want to control agriculture in the United States, and particularly with the growing integration with Mexico, that port and the materials coming down the Mississippi are ever more important. If you look up at the blog, I put up an infographic about where the jobs are being created, and sure enough, again, you see this pattern of the heartland. And remember, the Mississippi comes right down the heartland. Interestingly enough, New Orleans is the big port, but St. Louis is one of the critical ports along the Mississippi, as is Memphis. So Memphis, you drop down from Missouri past Tennessee, that's Memphis, and then down into Mississippi and out into the Delta, New Orleans. So, you know, if you want to understand power in America, you could see the old investment networks that got built around the Mississippi and the railroads. And it's almost as though we're returning to those networks getting rebuilt around the critical transportation networks that are going to carry the trade and the goods. Rick Perry, we were expecting Cuomo to be the governor to be indicted in this election season, but sure enough, Rick Perry got indicted, stood up, that's Rick Perry of Texas, gave a speech. He said, you know, we don't have political fights with criminal indictments. Well, I wish that was true, but the political sort of infighting in this country has turned to the use of the criminal machinery that started decades ago. The breakaways and the Bush group have taken it to a high art form. But you are now literally seeing the machinery eat through everyone. I would be very surprised if the indictment of Rick Perry, which is clearly You know, it's hard to believe that they have any solid ground at all, but it's hard to believe it would have gone forward if he hadn't been so tough on the border issue. And it kind of makes me wonder what the real fight is really about. So let's see if we can't tie this all together. What we're watching is all around the world, and we're certainly seeing it coming into the campaign period in the United States, more and more infighting, more and more meanness, more and more dirtball competition. It's part of what's driving the economy into the ground. I would say the lawlessness, as I said last week or two, is the greatest tax right now on the entire global economy. Up on the blog, it'll go up tonight or tomorrow, is a wonderful speech by a professor, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and Social Behavior at the University of California at Irvine, Paul Piff. It's about the cost of privilege and how privilege goes to people's heads and results in significantly more meanness in many cases, but there are conditions where we can turn that around. And one of the things it reminds me of is the extent to which people who've been able to use lawlessness and government subsidy to engineer their wealth truly don't understand what their privilege comes from. And Piff does a fabulous job of showing you how somebody who's clearly getting the benefits of a rigged game really starts to think that they're a better and more superior person. Bank bail-ins. I keep talking about bank bail-ins coming. G20 is moving closer to a reform where they get the top 29 banks globally to basically set up a bonding scheme to create their own capital for bail-ins. It's, you're trying to keep the cost of the bailouts to, in fact, the banks and not give them a cost of capital benefit because they are considered too big to fail. Whether or not this can work or not, I don't know, but it looks like they are planning on coming to an agreement by November and then putting it out for public comment, so it won't happen until next year. I put up Stanley Fischer, vice chairman of the Fed's first speech. It was in Stockholm. It's up on the blog, where, in fact, he talks about bail-ins. So this is serious, and they're working up to something. Again, I don't think anything other. We may get selected bail-ins of selected banks this year, but I don't expect to see anything big this year. Putin and the BRICS continue to keep working on trying to come up with alternative systems and new rules. It's a very fractious process, and it's going to take a long, long time. Of course, once it starts, as it has started, it's long run going to be bad news for the dollar, unless, of course, the digital currency and those arrangements can sort of jump the curve. I suspect if they do, it may not be the dollar. We'll just have to see. But a wonderful example of the challenges facing the BRICS is the UK Bank Standard Charter was part of an announcement by China that it could import gold into China. It was one of three banks, Standard Charter being the only non-Chinese bank, and in this three added to the list of banks that could import gold. This is happening as China's gearing up to launch a new bullion exchange in Shanghai. So this gets announced, and immediately thereafter, the New York regulators announce a new $300 million plus fine on Standard Charter for an old money laundering issue. And you kind of wonder if it isn't tit for tat. Although I'm sure that Cuomo and the New York politicians want more money for their coffers to hand out during the campaign. But a perfect example of the kind of politics that a big global bank is having to navigate if they try and work with and help the BRICS. And the dollar system can be very, very unforgiving. I put up a commentary this week called SeaWorld, Blackstone, and Blackfish. The stock of SeaWorld took a 33% dive last week, so I thought I would take a look at it and see what was going on, and that inspired me to write a commentary for subscribers. SeaWorld had been part of the Busch Garden sort of entertainment group that Anheuser-Busch sold to Blackstone more than a few years ago, and then Blackstone took it public in 2013. Registration was originally filed in December 2012, and then they took it public in the spring of 2013. It was one of about 20 plus reverse LBOs. That's when a private firm, private equity firm like Blackstone buys a company and, you know, takes it private. It's usually an LBO. They use debt to do it. And then they turn around and take it public. It's called a reverse LBO. When that happens, so I posted an article with the commentary. Yahoo Finance had published an article saying that the reverse LBOs that occurred over the last year have significantly underperformed the total basket of IPOs. It doesn't surprise me. And if you look at this, it's one of those horribly sad business stories where the leadership, instead of dealing with the real problem and trying to reinvent themselves or really come up with a jump-the-curve kind of situation, instead uses their time and resources to keep a lid on things while they help the big investors get out at the top at the cost of the public. And it was it's just one of those things that's very sad to see. It was their problems were inspired by a documentary that's very powerfully done. It's called Blackfish, and if you want to hear a sad story, there it is. One of our subscribers asked a comment or posted a comment, said, "Brilliant analysis, Catherine. I do have one question. Why would Blackstone be involved in SeaWorld in the first place? I'm seeing military industrial complex, advanced brain tech, underwater drones in the picture. I have no idea." I can, since they picked it up with other complexes, there could have been many reasons. If you look at the combination of all the Busch Garden attractions, there doesn't necessarily have to be a covert agenda. You're talking about a series of different complexes that can generate a fairly hefty cash flow. I do know that there is tremendous interest in the whale and dolphin population and how they relate to people. That is true. I can't see SeaWorld as a productive place to do that kind of research. If you listen to the interview I did with Adam Trombley on entrainment, what you would know is my experiences with entrainment in a speech form it's so remarkable because entrainment feels just like a junky synthetic version of what it's like to be with whales. If you've ever spent any time with whales, they are clearly so advanced in terms of their intelligence. It's an extraordinary experience to be around them. So I will say that, but I would not necessarily assume that there was a covert agenda when Blackstone picked up the Busch Garden operation, but there could have been. You never know. Anything that attracts and runs through that many families and kids, you know, there can always be another agenda. Good news up on the blog. Kickstarter closes the funding gap for women. Apparently, women are much more successful on Kickstarter than men. It's quite an interesting story, and you ought to take a look. And I was surprised because if you look at a lot of the money going through Kickstarter, one of the most successful categories is software developments and video games, and I had just assumed that was mostly men. But interestingly enough, women are getting a better success ratio on Kickstarter, so take a look. I'm sure there's a reason or there's meaning in that, but I'm not quite sure yet what it is. Again, I've said this several weeks in a row. I'm going to keep saying it. Get ready for cold this winter. Every indication, including the Farmer Almanac, is that this is going to be an even colder winter than last winter. So if you're in an area that was cold last winter, you may want to think about taking a break in February and getting to someplace warm. You certainly want to be prepared for power outages. You certainly want to be prepared to deal with hiccups in food supply and everything else. So let's take a look at the markets. The dollar broke up big. It's been kind of trading sideways, holding that 81 line or better. It's up 80 cents from where it started the week. It's trading at 82.20. So it looks like it has broken out. Not surprisingly, the U.S. stock market's headed up with it. The S&P is up 2% in the last five trading days. Emerging markets up about 0.5%. They're still coming up. Bonds were essentially flat, and gold was down almost 3%. commodities are way down. The agricultural commodities are really hurting. Between drought and the wheat and corn prices, the farmers are not going to have a wonderful year this year. You know, and they've been doing pretty well. This is going to be painful. There is no sign yet of a summer correction, and we are only a week away from Labor Day. So the bottom line is the bull market in the U.S. continues strong. All technical indicators continue strong. I have to ask, and I've been asking this week, is a crash up possible? Is it possible for PEs to rise even dramatically higher? That's a scenario where so much institutional money is looking to get away from sovereign credits. So it's really a reset between debt and equity now that the government assets have been shifted into private sector. The investment capital is looking to get out of government bonds and head into something that finances those assets. Interestingly enough, mortgage rates dropped as the lending terms loosened. So now, you know, the price of getting a mortgage is coming down, and now a lot more people, it looks like, will be able to get them. And I think part of that is they're loosening as the taper ends. The Department of Justice, talk about talk about politics. The Department of Justice has indicated that they are preparing civil charges against Angelo Mazzello of Countrywide. It looks like they're going to make him the poster child for the election. They need to go beat up on somebody about the housing bubble. That's one of the reasons I was really interested to see if Andrew Cuomo ends up being seriously charged by the U.S. attorney in New York for the Moreland Commission issues. If that happens, though, I can't believe they're not going to bring up the housing bubble. Because if you look at two of the people who really engineered the housing bubble, Angela Mazzillo and Andrew Cuomo, were absolutely two of them.